We're clearly an unrelated diversifier, operating a broadcast network named NBC, a jet engine business, an appliance business, a lighting business, a wider range of businesses during the 20th century. However, they had a management system, the GE way, a set of processes, a talent development machine, if you will, that spread across the businesses. They were instituting things like Six Sigma and spreading them across each unit. The GE workout process, the best practices transfer that Jack Welch introduced. Each of these were efforts to instill a common management system across the units and enhance performance. And it appeared for years that GE did this quite successfully. Now, this is easier to pull off when there's a clear dominant logic or common theme across many businesses. For many years, Emerson Electric was a successful unrelated diversifier led by CEO Chuck Knight. But each of the businesses was in manufacturing. Each was in a fairly mature sector. Each was pursuing a low-cost strategy. Each was with fairly mature technology. So there was a common thread, though the product markets were seemingly unrelated. It's much harder to pull off an unrelated business strategy when you have conflicting types of strategies and different business models across the units. When you mix a differentiation strategy in one subsidiary with a low-cost position in another. So is GE still as powerful today in its exercise and execution of governance economies? Some have begun to question that, even calling for GE to be broken up, as we've seen GE's stock underperform the market during the Jeff Immelt era as CEO. Why might it be that their governance economies today are not as powerful? Well, people have learned. People have learned about the GE way. The spread of knowledge is easy and costless in today's economy. So people have read about and learned about Six Sigma. They've learned about GE's workout process or transfer of best practices. And they've brought those practices to their corporation. In many cases, they've hired GE executives and brought them in to be able to do this. One thing I should note is we have to worry about overconfidence or conceit when someone says they have a superior management skill or system they can apply across a broad range of businesses. It's pretty hard to apply the same system across really different markets. Now, how do investors and analysts and even managers evaluate whether a company's whole is worth more than the sum of the parts? There are quantitative techniques we can use. One is a look at return on assets. And you can look at the return on assets of each unit within a company like Sara Lee or GE and compare that return on assets to what comparable focused competitors are doing. And you have to ask yourself the question, are the units within a GE outperforming their direct rivals? If they are, then maybe there's some value being added by the GE corporate parent. If not, maybe they should be broken up. Similarly, we can actually do a comparison of the whole to the sum of the parts. We can evaluate what each of the units is worth if it was spun off, or try to estimate that, add that all up, that's just sum of the parts, and compare it to what the current total market value of the firm is. And this is what's happening in 2014 with firms like HP, Symantec, eBay, and Gannett, where we've concluded that there's more value in breaking it up. Now, what if we move around the world to different places? What does that tell us? Can we come to the same conclusions about unrelated diversification? Well, we cannot. Research by Tarun Khanna has shown that while unrelated diversification may no longer make sense in developed economies like the UK or the United States, when we go to emerging markets like India, we may see something very different, where large unrelated diversifiers may actually do quite well still today. Why is that? Khanna pointed to the idea of institutional voids. He argued that a capitalist economic system requires the effective functioning of certain institutions that enable parties to enter voluntarily into mutually beneficial transactions. Institutional voids occur when specialized intermediaries are absent. Intermediaries are economic entities that insert themselves between a potential buyer and a seller in an attempt to bring them together and help them engage in a mutually beneficial transaction. Consider, for instance, a firm pursuing a differentiation strategy, trying to achieve high willingness to pay. Certain intermediaries may enable potential buyers to confirm the quality of the firm's products, say consumer reports. Moreover, certain intermediaries may help the firm assess consumer tastes, like a market research firm. And other intermediaries may certify high quality, like government regulatory agencies. There are many intermediaries that help make transactions work in a developed economy like the United States. In the capital markets, we have auditors who verify your financial statements so investors have confidence in giving you money. We have private equity providers or venture capital firms that help bring together savers with people who need capital. In the labor markets, we have headhunting firms and certification agencies, business schools, and relocation services that help match good candidates with great job opportunities. In the product markets, we have certification agencies, we have regulatory agencies, and others who help verify the quality of products. And through all markets, we have a judiciary that operates to enforce the rule of law and clear property rights. All of these intermediaries help make markets work in a developed economy. But do those intermediaries exist in emerging markets? Not to the same extent. Therefore, what happens? Well, in this void, where these institutions don't exist, in steps the large corporation, the unrelated diversifier, who can provide that value. So if you're in India, a company like the House of Tata can create a lot of value as an unrelated diversifier, where we would question that strategy in the U.S. Now, Khan has actually looked at the evidence and shown that the diversification discount that we see in the U.S. is not existent in a place like India. Family business groups that are in unrelated businesses are ubiquitous, where we don't see many unrelated diversifiers anymore in the United States. And the percentage of conglomerates trading at a discount, well, it's below 50% in India, while it's much higher than 50% in the U.S. So let's take a look at the House of Tata for a moment. Consider the nature of inefficiencies in three markets in India: product markets, capital markets, and labor markets. And consider, too, the rule of law and property rights in that country. While India's come a long way, we still know that there are inefficiencies in these markets, and we have a lot of corruption, meaning that the rule of law is not quite as clear and contracts not as enforceable. So what happens? In steps the House of Tata. If there aren't clear ways to certify the quality of goods and services, Tata putting its name on a product gives the Indian people confidence that it's a high-quality good. If you're not sure where you can get talent for a new emerging business, well, you know, if you're part of the Tata family, they can reallocate great talent from an established business and move it over because they're really good at recruiting and developing talent. And as for capital, well, they can move capital from successful businesses and push it into new emerging opportunities because the external capital market is not as effective or efficient as doing so in a place like India, so Tata steps into the breach. And if you're trying to launch a business, it can be difficult in a place like India. You have to navigate the politics to be able to do so. Well, how do you do that? You go to Ratan Tata, longtime head of the company, or its current management, and you ask for their help. And they use their connections with key political leaders to help you navigate the permitting and the regulatory process to be able to get the right things all lined up so you can launch your business. So Tata makes up for the inefficiencies in the market, and therefore we see that they can add value to the businesses in their portfolio in a way an unrelated diversifier could not in a place like the United States. Now, what's happened in the United States with regard to conglomerates or unrelated diversifiers since the 1960s and 70s? If we go back three or four decades, what we see is there were many of these unrelated diversifiers. They were high flyers, excellent performers. ITT, Textron, Sara Lee, Litton Industries, not just GE, but many of these kinds of firms. Today, many of these conglomerates have been dismantled. As I noted, even in 2014, we're seeing more and more breakups of large corporations, even some that we thought were more related than unrelated. Well, what's changed in the United States since the 60s that would cause us to see this strategy shift from many successful unrelated diversifiers to far fewer today, the dismantling of these large conglomerates? Well, think about the product, labor, and capital markets in the United States over the past four decades. They've become much more efficient. If you were an entrepreneur in the 60s, did you have easy access to capital from angel investors and venture capital firms the way you do today? You did not. Were there customer reviews online to help you vouch for the quality of your product, to build buzz and reputation? There were not. Were there as many opportunities to get access to the most talented people? Was it as easy to find the best people? It was harder to do so. So with markets that were less efficient than they are today, conglomerates still made sense. In other words, the U.S. in the 60s looked a lot more like the emerging markets today, and so there was a valid rationale with those institutional voids for unrelated diversifiers to fill that. Today, with far fewer institutional voids in developed countries, we see far fewer unrelated diversifiers. So we've seen a big shift in the kind of strategy that firms are pursuing. And we've seen pressure from investors and analysts who are calculating that breakup value, who are looking and saying, is the whole really worth more than the sum of the parts? Increasingly, we're seeing that happen with firms that where management is claiming, no, no, we're not unrelated. We're actually a related diversifier. And there are synergies. And investors are skeptical. Do we really see scope economies? Do we believe your governance economy argument? Do we really think you can use one management system to manage a wide array of unrelated businesses in different product markets? So over time, more and more skepticism, because investors and analysts know that academic research that shows that focus wins over unrelated diversification. And so they've pressured firms, and more breakups have occurred. This is not to say that every breakup makes sense, but it does say that there's a lot of cynicism and skepticism about these strategies, and management must be ready to defend their diversification efforts. So what are our overall lessons? The evidence says focus wins in the United States. We have to understand the difference between economies of scope in a firm like Disney and governance economies in a firm like GE, and understand the potential limits of the governance economy argument in developed nations today. We have to understand that diversifying risk is not a valid reason to pursue an unrelated expansion. Investors in developed markets can diversify on their own quite easily and inexpensively. And we simply know that the manager of a company, much like the manager of a mutual fund, on average, is not going to beat the market. We can do better by investing in the market overall than trying to have a manager pick winners and losers by buying and selling companies in a portfolio. We can apply some quantitative tests to evaluate these companies. We can actually calculate the whole versus the sum of the parts and try to understand, do we believe that the whole is truly worth more than what these companies would be worth on their own? It's a difficult quantitative analysis with many assumptions, but it can be done. And finally, we understood that in emerging economies, it can still make sense to pursue a strategy of unrelated diversification the way the House of Tata has in India and other firms have done in many other emerging markets around the world. And Khanna's empirical research shows that these unrelated diversifiers are high performers. So your assignment for this lecture, take a look at the corporate breakups that have occurred in recent years, eBay and HP, Sara Lee, Fortune Brands, Tyco. What do you think of these? Do they make sense? And are there other companies headed for similar breakups moving forward? Try to identify at least one candidate, a firm where you think there are limited scope economies and where serious questions should be raised about whether the whole is worth more than the sum of the parts. Can you predict the next great corporate breakup?
This lecture is titled Forward and Backward Integration.
Suppose that a firm produces tractors, snow blowers, and other lawn and garden equipment. Traditionally, they've distributed and sold those tractors, snow blowers, and other pieces of equipment through big box stores such as Home Depot and Lowe's. Now, management is pondering a shift in strategy. They've decided that they'd like to open their own chain of retail stores where they will exclusively sell their own products, their own brand of equipment, and no other brands. Management articulates the rationale for this strategic shift. They tell investors that they will improve the profitability of their business because they will capture the profit margin currently being generated by these outside retailers such as Lowe's and Home Depot. In other words, Lowe's and Home Depot mark up the product that they purchase from this manufacturer, and they then capture that markup when they make a sale. The company's arguing, why give that markup to Lowe's and Home Depot? We'll take it for ourselves by directly retailing our own products in our own chain of stores. Is this sound logic? I'm going to argue that no, it is not at all sound strategic logic. We are going to capture the margin or the markup. What does that mean? Well, if we were to supply something in-house, in other words, if we were to make our own components instead of buying them from an outside party, The argument is we won't have to pay the profit margin that the supplier of that component is generating. If, such as this firm, which is selling snowblowers and the like, we retail it ourselves, the argument is we capture the profit margin that the retailer is generating when they make a sale. Why is this argument about capturing the margin a fallacy? Well, think about retailing for a moment. This company is going to go out there and distribute and sell their own products in their own stores. Will they capture the profit margin? Well, yes, they will. But what will it take to capture that profit margin currently being generated by Lowe's and Home Depot? You have to invest in a lot of assets. There's no free lunch. You have to go out and build stores or lease them. You have to hire staff. You have to put fixtures in those stores. You have to train your staff and your salespeople and compensate them, create incentives for them to sell your products. Train them in how to do so. That means it's costly to go out and try to build that chain of stores and execute that strategy. There's no free lunch. You can't just capture the margin without having to spend a lot of money to do so. And the question is, are you spending it appropriately? The real issue then is, who will conduct that retailing activity in the most efficient way possible? Who will generate the best return for investors by building out and operating retail stores? And the question then becomes not, are you capturing the margin, but can you retail your products as effectively as outsiders can do so? Who's going to do it and generate a better return on assets for investors? And so you should only move to forward or backward integrate if it makes economic sense. You shouldn't do it simply because you're going to capture that markup or margin. Vertical integration, that's the strategy we're talking about in this lecture. And there are two forms of vertical integration. Let's suppose we're a manufacturer of personal computers. We assemble personal computers, a firm like Dell, Hewlett-Packard, or the like. Backward integration means that the manufacturer builds its own components, its own hard drives. It designs and builds its own operating system or perhaps its own microprocessors. Forward integration means it's choosing to distribute its own products through perhaps its own retail store network, like Apple does when it owns and operates its own retail stores in malls throughout the country. What are some examples of vertical integration? For forward integration, an obvious example is Apple and its store network. But we have other companies that have embarked on forward integration strategies as well. Ducati, the Italian motorcycle company, owns a chain of stores that market its products. Disney stores in many malls around the country and around the world. We see Disney operating its own retail stores, selling exclusively Disney products. To go outside of the consumer products business, we might look at a firm like Fresenius. Fresenius is a company that makes dialysis equipment, headquartered in Germany. In many countries, especially in the United States, they've chosen to forward integrate. They also operate dialysis clinics where patients come in for treatment. They're using the dialysis equipment made by Fresenius, but then you also have Fresenius medical staff performing the treatment on patients in these clinics, a strategy of forward integration. What about backward integration? Do we have some examples of that? When Apple conducts the work to build, design, and sell its own operating system, that's backward integration. Many of its competitors, such as Dell and Hewlett-Packard, do not make their own operating system. They're not backward integrated. They're buying an operating system from an outside party, namely Microsoft. We also see that Weyerhaeuser is backward integrated. They sell paper products, cardboard, and other things, but they own their own forests. They cut the timber and then manufacture the products. So they're backward integrated. They're going back toward the earth, and they're owning the whole process from raw materials through finished paper products. These are examples of backward integration. So let's dig deep on a story of vertical integration and see whether it makes economic sense. And here I want to look at the saga of Disney stores. An interesting one because it's a strategy where vertical integration may have made sense at one time, and then perhaps became more questionable as a strategy as time evolved. As different players emerged in the toy retailing business, as new pressures emerged competitively that Disney had to face, as it operated these stores and malls around the country. So when did Disney launch this forward integration strategy? It happened early in the tenure of Michael Eisner as CEO. During the 1980s, Disney launched retail stores. And initially, they prospered. And so Disney opened more stores, and they grew the business, and they achieved great financial success. Around the beginning of the 21st century, though, the chain began to embark on some difficult changes. It was struggling. Financial performance had lagged, and the company didn't know how to turn the business around. Finally, they chose to strike a deal with Children's Place, another retailer known for being able to retail children's apparel quite successfully in its own chain of stores. Under this agreement, Children's Place would take over the operation of Disney stores in malls around the world. Now, this didn't mean they would rebrand the stores. The stores would continue to operate under the Disney brand, but Children's Place would bring its retailing expertise, its knowledge, its talent to these stores to try to improve their profitability. It didn't work. After several years, Children's Place chose to terminate the agreement with Disney. It chose to turn the stores back over to the Walt Disney Corporation. Now Disney faced an important choice. What do we do? Do we take back control and start to operate and manage these stores for ourselves? Or do we shut down the stores? Do we admit that perhaps this strategy, which was once a prosperous one, no longer makes sense given a new competitive environment? After all, people are now buying their toys on the web. More and more we're buying toys from Walmart, from Toys R Us, and Target, not from independent toy stores in 2014. Times have changed from the 1980s when Eisner began this forward integration strategy. Disney talked it over and decided to keep the stores. They put Jim Fielding in charge of the stores, and he began a strategy of redesigning the Disney stores. The goal was to make them more of an experience. What was going on there? Well, interestingly, at the time, Steve Jobs was on the board of directors of Disney. Having sold Pixar to Disney, he took a seat on the board, and he became a prominent shareholder of the Disney Corporation. And they consulted with Jobs. After all, he had forward integrated and opened Apple stores, and that had been very successful. Jobs' argument was you should only forward integrate if you're creating an experience in the stores that helps you raise willingness to pay, where you are truly enhancing the competitive advantage of this unit, creating something where people are willing to pay more for the product because you're retailing it yourself than if they were to buy the products at Walmart or Target. And are you selling enough unique products that aren't sold on the web or at Walmart, Target, and Toys R Us that draws people in as they see this exclusive offering in your own stores? So Disney began to redesign. And they put a lot into it. In Manhattan, they shut down the store and actually moved to a new location with a more experiential design. They wanted to move more toward the kind of retailing experience that we see at a store like American Girl, where girls, young girls, go in to buy dolls, but not only do they buy a doll, they can take their old dolls to the hospital to get them fixed if they're broken. They can go to the cafe and have lunch with their doll. They can get the doll's hair done at the salon. In other words, American Girl made something that was deeply experiential, something that you couldn't outsource to a Walmart or a Target, something you could only do in a store that exclusively sold your own products. Of course, this was expensive. You don't do this with little money. You've got to put a lot of money in. And the question is, can you generate enough new revenue to justify that? There's an important point here, right? If you're going to operate your own stores, you've got to do something different that truly enables you to retail your product in a way that others could not do it for you. After all, Walmart and Target are much more efficient, much more effective. They have a lot more expertise in how to run a retail store. And they, therefore, have lower costs than you. The only reason, therefore, Disney should own its own stores is if it can raise willingness to pay for the products in the stores and for other Disney products that are sold in different places within the Disney portfolio. Note the difference between Disney and Apple. The Apple stores are clearly experiential. After all, you go there, you receive training, counseling, questions, you go to the Genius Bar. There are things that happen in the store that aren't going to happen at a Best Buy. And so therefore, you are adding value by owning your own store network. It's a little less clear if Disney has that same kind of value add by operating its own retail stores. So you see the conundrum Disney faces. Create more of an experience. But if it's too much of an experience, if you can easily meet the characters such as Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck at the stores, then why go to the park? If you have too little of an experience, then why not go to Target and buy the products less expensively? This is a real conundrum. You need the experience to give a reason, a rationale for why you should operate your own stores, but you don't want it to be too experiential because you don't want to cannibalize your efforts to drive revenue at the parks and in other locations. One happy medium that some companies have chosen in terms of vertical integration is operating flagship stores. Think American Girl or M&M World, right? You can buy M&Ms in Manhattan at a store where they only sell the M&M family of products. Or you can buy American Girl toys at American Girl stores. But is there one of these stores in every mall in the country? There's not. They operate flagship stores. Just a few of these stores in certain locations, they draw people in, their destinations. They help build the brand and raise willingness to pay for the products, but they're not trying to exclusively retail products only in their own stores, and they're not trying to operate one in every mall in the country. So what then is the overall rationale for vertical integration, now that we've looked at the story of a few companies trying this strategy? Well, first and foremost, you may do it because you have this hold-up problem. You know, the oil refinery and the pipeline. Why might they come together and vertically integrate? Because each is so dependent on the other that they can't come to a contractual agreement and hold to that agreement in an effective manner. Each is worried about opportunistic behavior on the part of the other party. You may do it because there's some synergy between businesses at different points in the supply chain, economies of scale or scope, perhaps. You may vertically integrate. Perhaps you might backward integrate, for example, if you want to secure access to a crucial input. Perhaps this component or raw material is scarce. You're worried about having enough of it to be able to produce enough of your finished product to meet customer demand. So you're going to backward integrate to make sure you've got access to key raw materials or key inputs. You may even do it to foreclose access on the part of your competitors, to stop them from having easy access to a scarce input. You also may backward or forward integrate to offset the bargaining power of suppliers or buyers. What do I mean by that? Suppose you have some powerful suppliers who have negotiating leverage over you. Maybe you backward integrate so that you have a little more power at the bargaining table. You maybe know more about the cost structure of suppliers and what it takes to produce that good. And you have an alternative. You can get the product from your own factory and not have to rely on the outside party, and that gives you leverage at the negotiating table. Similarly, you can do the same thing with offsetting the bargaining power of buyers. If you're worried about the fact that Walmart is such a tough negotiator at the table when you're looking to sell goods to them as a retailer, perhaps you want to retail the good yourself in certain stores, find a way around Walmart so you're not as dependent on them. Certainly you may do it to elevate barriers to entry. The more vertically integrated you are, the more expensive it is for an entrepreneur to come in and replicate that strategy. It's expensive for you, but it also raises the barriers for new players to come in. You may do it to enhance your ability to differentiate your product in the product markets. Can you raise willingness to pay through the kind of experience you create in your own distribution channel? Something Apple has tried to do and Ducati has as well. And finally, are you acquiring important information that you otherwise could not acquire? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you leave retailing to outside parties, that means they're the ones touching your customer every day and talking to them. But maybe you want to be the one talking to your customer every day because there's crucial data, information you could collect through that interaction. And therefore, you want to be forward integrated because you want to be closer to that customer. Well, that all sounds wonderful. There must be some risk or cost to vertical integration. There sure is. There is a real downside here we have to consider. And it starts with dulled incentives. Think about being backward integrated. If I'm not backward integrated, if I simply buy my components from outside parties, they, the independent entrepreneurs running those component manufacturing businesses, they have every incentive to work hard. They're playing with their own money, and they want to generate a good return. If, on the other hand, I have my own factory, and I have a factory manager making a salary, they don't have the same incentive to really go after this business because they know that basically the product they make has an automatic customer in the downstream manufacturing operation within the same corporation. So that's an issue. There's also the issue of conflict of interest that emerges. So you now have forward integrated. But now you're competing with your own customers. Apple is competing with Best Buy, yet Best Buy is a crucial Apple customer. And sometimes that creates conflicts of interest, and that can be difficult. Vertical integration also means it reduces your flexibility to change partners. If I'm outsourcing and I don't like what a component manufacturer is doing, I can switch. I can go find someone who's doing it better or someone who's got the next great technology. But if I'm doing it myself, it's harder to exit that business and to change technology, to change processes, to do it differently. There's also higher fixed costs in the business if you vertically integrate. And that can be difficult when times are tough. During a recession, if you've got high fixed costs and business starts to sag, can you cover those fixed costs? It's also harder to get out of the business. The exit barriers rise significantly. And there are internal conflicts that emerge as you try to get your different parts of the company to work together. One has to sell its parts effectively to a downstream business, and you have to use some artificial price to negotiate that internal sale for purposes of being able to record and track performance of each unit. And battles can emerge as people try to understand, well, what price should we use? What transfer price should we use to move a product from component manufacturing to final assembly? And lastly, there are costs associated with managing very different businesses. There are really different managerial requirements to running a retail chain versus a manufacturing operation. Can the same executive team oversee such different businesses? Now, one strategy that some have chosen as an alternative to full vertical integration is what we call tapered or partial integration. This is where you use some outside retailers as well as your own stores. You use outside suppliers as well as your own factories. You use a blend. Now, what are the benefits there? Well, you might expose your in-house units to outside competition. And that might be a way to make sure everyone has the incentive to maximize performance. It gives you more flexibility, and it allows you to learn quickly because you can transfer knowledge from outside parties to internal units and vice versa by having a bit of both in the same firm. You can embark on strategic outsourcing, choosing carefully about where you might do so. And you may have deep relationships in many cases, not just a transaction. So you have a long-term partner as opposed to full vertical integration. The Japanese automakers really did this effectively in the 80s as they grew their business, and in contrast to General Motors. General Motors was highly vertically integrated, while the Japanese used long-term relationships and long-term partnerships to work with suppliers who were outside parties, but it wasn't just a handoff, dumping product over the wall from one factory to the other. It was an intense relationship where employees were in each other's factories working hard to coordinate their activity, much like they would be if they were employees of the same corporation. But in fact, they weren't. They were separate entities, but they were partnered closely to achieve optimal performance. And that kind of long-term relationship can be an alternative to full vertical integration. What have we witnessed in recent years about vertical integration, particularly in developed nations in many industries, such as computers and automobiles? We've seen a dramatic decline in vertical integration. Well, why might that be? Well, let's go back to transaction cost theory, the theories produced by Coase and Williamson that we've talked about in prior lectures. The transaction costs associated with using the market have gone down dramatically. In other words, I can outsource much more easily today than I could 30 years ago. The web and easier travel and communication around the world has enabled me to partner with people in very different parts of the globe and to work with those who are much more efficient at doing something that I could be myself. That was much more difficult to do in the 1950s and 60s, and so vertical integration may have made more sense for a firm such as Ford or General Motors. But today, we don't have to do that necessarily, as the transaction costs of working with outside parties have fallen considerably. So let's take a look at an example of a highly successful vertically integrated strategy, one that's really counterintuitive, that has cut against the grain of what many in their own industry have been doing over the recent years. And that would be a Spanish retailer named Zara. Zara has been wildly successful in recent years while pursuing an interesting vertical integration strategy, in contrast to many of their rivals. Zara produces a significant portion of their own clothes in their own factories in North Africa, and in Western Europe, near their own home base in Spain. Why is that unique? Well, many of their competitors, such as H&M and The Gap, these apparel retailers don't produce any of their own products. They are purely marketing and retail machines. They outsource all manufacturing to low-cost players in Asia or Latin America. Now, Zara has been very successful, and they've outperformed the average firm in the apparel industry. How have they done it, and why has vertical integration helped them when, as we've said, many companies have moved away from vertical integration in recent years? Well, they pursue something called a fast fashion strategy. They're not looking to be the company coming out with the bleeding-edge fashions before anyone else. They're looking to the great luxury apparel companies who are premiering new fashions on runways in Milan and Paris. And then what they're doing is pursuing a fast follower strategy. They want to move quickly, nimbly, and flexibly to be able to see what's hot out there and bring it to market, and to do so at a price point that's much lower than what luxury apparel houses like Gucci might do. How have they done that? Well, they produce their products in small batches, and they change their product mix very quickly and constantly. They're not producing huge batches of the same goods and putting them in all their stores for lengthy periods of time. If you go today, you'll see different clothes than you saw a month ago. And you may not see hot clothes that did very well stay in the stores for very long. Now, they don't produce all their clothes in-house. Interestingly, they've used a tapered integration or partial integration strategy. They've outsourced some and kept others in-house. What have they done? Well, those fashions, those fast fashions that they want to be able to change very quickly, they do those in their own factories. The basics, t-shirts for example, things that don't change much year to year, they outsource those to low-cost manufacturers in Asia, capitalizing on the economies of scale and the efficiencies that those manufacturers have. So what are the benefits of this vertical integration strategy at Zara? Well, they don't end up with a ton of excess inventory if they make a wrong bet on a particular fashion. In other words, they're making fast, small bets. What's the result of that strategy? Being able to work very closely with their own factories, many of them in close proximity to their corporate headquarters in Spain. They're able to quickly change their product mix. They're not making a giant bet on a new fashion. They don't have to sign a contract with someone in Asia with long lead times, and they don't have to commit to buying thousands and thousands of the same piece of new fashionable clothing. As a result, by working with small, fast bets, they have far fewer markdowns. And when they mark down a product, it tends to be by a much smaller percentage on average than their rivals. They're not dumping excess inventory with sales all the time. Now, that's pretty incredible. To be able to reduce markdowns is a huge boost to profitability in the retail business. Of course, there is a disadvantage to this vertical integration strategy. Their labor costs are much higher than their rivals. Producing goods in Western Europe and in North Africa, well, that is much more expensive than doing so in Asia. But how do they make up for that? By being flexible. Being able to produce in small batches very quickly means fewer markdowns, means having to dump excess inventory much less frequently. The fewer markdowns and the smaller markdowns mean that they totally offset the labor cost disadvantage that they have and actually have better operating margins than their average retail rival. Well, if this is such a great strategy, why aren't other apparel retailers following it? It's fundamentally risky. You have to be bold to be different, and you have to take some risk. Zara has been willing to do it. Most in their industry have not been willing to do it. What are the risks? There are a tremendous fixed costs associated with backward integration at Zara. You have to build these factories, and that's expensive. And those costs are fixed. If you don't utilize the full capacity of those factories, then you've got a real cost problem. There are also tremendous exit barriers. What happens if things don't work out at a particular factory? Can you shut it down? Well, if you're operating in Western Europe, given the law and given the political context, it's very difficult to downsize or shut one of those factories. You cannot get out easily. You're tied down, and that's a risk. You also have to be able to fund these capital investments. And that means having to take out more debt, perhaps, which Czar has had to do at times, in order to fund the building of these factories. And finally, you have to accept lower asset turnover. You're not going to generate the same utilization of assets and the same efficiency as a company that's completely outsourcing. And so you have to be able to make up for that with better profit margins, which they've done by having fewer markdowns. But if you don't get that, you run the risk of having much lower returns for your investors. Now, interestingly, Czar has not pursued the same strategy everywhere around the globe. Do they have stores that they own in every country? They have not. In Western Europe, they own their own stores. They are forward integrated. But in some countries, they set up joint ventures to operate stores. And in others, such as in the Middle East, they've actually worked with franchisees who own and operate the stores under a contractual agreement. So Czara exemplifies the idea that there's a spectrum of choices from contracts and markets through full ownership, with franchising and alliances and joint ventures in between. And they varied their corporate strategy, their vertical integration strategy, to fit the conditions in certain countries. In some countries, you have to joint venture. The governments will not allow you to have a wholly owned subsidiary. In others, we have high political instability and really different cultures. So we want local franchisees with a stake in the business who know the local customs and who understand conditions. And by working with franchisees, we put less capital at risk in a politically unstable environment. Can Czara be easily copied? There's a great article about a decade ago by James Surowiecki in The New Yorker. Surowiecki is a regular columnist on business in that magazine, and he's the author of a great book called The Wisdom of Crowds. And writing about Czara, he articulates many of the philosophies of this course on strategy. He says at one point, Czara is an integrated system, not just a collection of parts. You can't simply adopt elements of the system and expect similar results. So think about what we've been preaching in this course, that a great strategy is not about a core competence, but an integrated system of capabilities. An integrated system that fits together really well to produce powerful competitive advantage. And what happens to rivals? They try to copy elements of the system and not the whole thing and cannot produce the same kind of results. And Surowiecki makes the argument that with Czara, you have to be able to do everything they do, not just pieces of what they do, to make that vertical integration strategy so successful. So what are the lessons here? Well, don't just pursue vertical integration to capture the margin. That's not a valid reason to backward or forward integrate. You have to be able to add value by owning different parts of the supply chain. You have to be able to do things more efficiently or effectively than outside parties could do so. You have to understand the costs and benefits of that strategy as well as the alternatives. Could you do it a different way through a long-term relationship, a joint venture, a franchising agreement, some other way that you could achieve some of the benefits without having to put all of the capital in yourself and try to manage it all yourself? And finally, it's not an either-or issue. You don't have to say, are we going to vertically integrate or not, 0-1. You could choose a middle path we call tapered integration, where you do some forward or backward integration, but you still work with outside parties, and you achieve the learning that can happen when you mix the two together in the same corporation. So now for your assignment for this lecture. Take a look at some firms practicing vertical integration. Let's take two, for example. Let's take Apple. Does vertical integration make sense at Apple? They make some of their own inputs, including their own operating system, and they run their own stores. Why might that make sense? And then perhaps contrast that with some retailers who are doing it where it looks like they're less successful. What's different at those retailers? And then look at a firm like Delta in a very different industry. It's an airline that several years ago acquired an oil refinery. Why might they do that? Does it make sense or not, given what we've discussed? And having reviewed that, hopefully you get a better understanding of the rationale and the risks of vertical integration strategies.
This lecture is titled Mergers and Acquisitions, The Winner's Curse.
Mergers and acquisitions are part of daily life in the business world. It seems that not a day passes without news of another new deal, a large company acquiring a small one with an exciting new product, or two giant firms combining in a merger of equals. Not all these mergers work out, though. Some of them have disastrous results. Let's take three examples. A while back, Daimler, the parent company of Mercedes, acquired Chrysler, one of America's three largest automakers. The purchase price, $36 billion. Some years later, Daimler sold Chrysler for $7.4 billion for an 80% stake. Though even that was actually not the real price, because much of that $7.4 billion was plowed back in to try to recharge Chrysler operations. In short, Daimler bought a company for $36 billion and some years later simply gave it away. AOL Time Warner, a $182 billion merger at the height of the dot-com boom, later split up after disappointing performance. And if we go back several decades, we can look at the New York Central and Pennsylvania Railroads coming together in a historic merger in the late 1960s. But that new firm went bankrupt after only a few years. Unfortunately, there are too many instances where we've seen these mega deals go south and not produce results for shareholders. In this lecture, we'll take a look at why and how mergers and acquisitions happen. What's the strategic logic behind these deals? When do they make sense? When might they actually decrease shareholder value? What's a merger? A merger is when two firms come together to form a new combined entity. An acquisition is when one company purchases another and takes charge. Now, sometimes we read about two large companies like Daimler and Chrysler, and they articulate the notion that it's a merger of equals. Two equal parties coming together to form a new exciting company. In reality, there is no such thing as a merger of equals. In almost every case, one management team takes charge and begins to assert its authority over the managers in the other company. It's almost always the case that it's not, in fact, a merger of equals. And then, of course, there's an important distinction between friendly deals and unfriendly deals. A friendly deal is when one company acquires another and the selling party is friendly. They are accepting of the deal. They're not fighting the acquisition. But sometimes we have a company go in and try to execute a hostile takeover. That's when the target firm they're trying to acquire is not cooperative. They don't actually want to be sold. They want to stay independent. But a hostile takeover is when the acquiring firm goes directly to the shareholders and tries to convince them to sell, even if management and the board do not want to sell. And we'll look at why hostile takeovers may make sense in certain cases. Now, how does one of these deals work? Well, let's suppose that the stock price of a target firm, a firm that's being acquired, trades at X dollars per share. The acquiring firm tends to pay a significant premium over X dollars per share when they do the deal, sometimes 20 to 40% more than the shares are currently trading at in the market. What happened? How could the value of the firm suddenly rise by 20 to 40%? The acquiring firm must believe that somehow this unit will now be more valuable as part of their corporation than it was as an independent entity. In other words, they must believe that economies of scope exist. And the acquiring firm has valued those synergies. And that value for the synergies becomes the maximum premium that they're willing to pay for this target company. Now, who makes out? Who generates a wonderful return in these kinds of deals? Well, the target firm shareholders, they definitely do well. They get a premium for their shares. As I said, sometimes a very significant premium. The acquiring firm, well, in many cases, their share price actually declines slightly. Why? Markets and investors are often skeptical that these firms can realize the synergies. Remember, not only do they have to realize synergies, but they have to realize synergies in excess of the premium they had to pay to get control of the target firm. And that is a really difficult challenge. Many deals don't lead to long-run increases in shareholder value. The synergies that are produced do not exceed the premium that the acquiring firm had to pay. Now, there's a debate about how many deals work out and how many don't, and academics have studied this for some time. But all of them agree that a huge number of deals do not work out. Whether it's a majority or not, that's up for debate. But many deals do not produce long-run returns for the acquiring firm. Remember, the target firm is estimating the synergies as well. They are trying to understand what added value will be created if we become part of this new entity. And they, therefore, are trying to capture most of the value of those synergies in the price that they take, that they get for selling their company. So they're negotiating hard, and they're trying to get as many of those synergies embedded in the sale price. The acquiring firm may end up overpaying. Now, you also see bidding wars emerge at times, where multiple firms are trying to acquire the very same company. And why might one firm be willing to pay much more than another firm for the same company? A valid reason would be that the acquirer feels that the target is more valuable to them than any other firm, that there are more synergies that will be produced if this target firm joins their company than if it joins any other company. That would be a valid reason. But sometimes that's not what actually drives the acquirer's behavior. They're simply bidding up the value and the price they're willing to pay because they want to win. And that can be dangerous. Getting in a bidding war and starting to irrationally value the target firm can cause long-term harm. How do you value a deal? It can't be easy, right? How do you understand the potential synergies of a company you haven't operated and managed? You've only understood from afar. Well, there are different methodologies. You're going to do what's called due diligence. You're going to study the firm and try to get to know it and understand it. And through that, you're going to try to project what it will be worth to you. Now, what is a company worth? How do we understand that? That's a key question that investors and financial experts have looked at for many years. There are multiple methodologies for valuing a firm. But here's the quick way of thinking about it. When we buy a stock, what does that share price represent? Does it represent what the company has done in the past? Is it reflective of past earnings and performance? It's not really. When you're buying a stock, you are becoming a part owner in a company. But you don't get the right to past earnings. You get the right to future earnings. So the value of a company today is equal to the net present value of future cash flows. So using a discounted cash flow technique can be a way that an acquiring firm values a company they're looking to buy. They're trying to estimate its cash flows moving forward and then discounting them back to today's dollars. Why do they do that? Because a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. Now, as part of that, they're not just estimating the current company's financials, but they're trying to project those synergies into those cash flows going forward as well. But there are other methodologies. So, for example, you may look at a price-earnings multiple methodology or other financial techniques that you might use and compare the valuation from those techniques to a traditional discounted cash flow model. But here's the real challenge with any of these techniques or models. Often they include many assumptions. Assumptions that can vary wildly depending on who's conducting the analysis. And the analysis itself and its conclusions, we find that quite often the conclusions are highly sensitive to a few core assumptions. What kind of assumptions? Assumptions about how much you expect revenue to grow in the future. Assumptions about what you think will happen to operating margins or gross margins moving forward. Assumptions about how challenging it will be to realize certain synergies. And as you tweak those assumptions, you often see dramatic changes in the estimated value of a firm you're looking to acquire. So what happens in many of these deals? Well, if executives really want to do the deal, they often keep working the assumptions till they get the valuation they want that will justify doing the deal. In other words, the analysis doesn't drive the conclusion, but instead the conclusion, I want to buy this company, drives the analysis. And that can happen in many, many deals. And in fact, it happened to some extent in Daimler's acquisition of Chrysler. Now, one problem in all of these analyses is that while a lot of attention is paid to valuing the synergies, not enough attention is paid to what investments will we have to make? What costs are there to achieving those synergies? At Polycom, a company that competes in the telecommunications and video conferencing business, when they would do deals, they often would talk about estimating the anti-synergies, something most firms don't do. In other words, what are the losses we might incur as we try to push two firms together? In other words, it's not all positive. Sometimes there's some negatives of meshing two firms together. Now, Richard Thaler at the University of Chicago has tried to give us an explanation for why sometimes bidders pay too much when they do deals. So he's articulated something he calls the winner's curse. Now, suppose you have an auction, says Thaler, when the bidders do not know the actual value of an object that others have placed on that object. So they think they have a value for the object, but they don't know what others value the object, and they're bidding in an auction. The bidders are each estimating the value and making a bid, and let's assume that the value is closest, the real value is closest to the average bid in the auction. So there are a lot of people bidding, people are putting different values on this thing that they're trying to buy, and the average bid is pretty close to the real underlying value. But who wins the auction? The highest bidder wins the auction. The highest bidder walks away with the thing that they've been trying to buy. But note, if the real underlying value of the asset is equal to the average bid, the winner, the highest bid, is overpaying for this asset. The winner's curse. The winner has achieved the thing that they've been striving to get, to acquire this company, but they paid more than the actual value. And the winner's curse is Thaler's explanation for why we may see many deals that don't generate a positive return for shareholders. Now, it's interesting to listen to executives. What do they say when they do a deal? They clearly are trying to convince investors, employees, and others that synergies exist. What kind of synergies do they talk about when they do a deal? Some studies have shown that they tend to talk much more about cost synergies than revenue synergies. In other words, they talk about ways that when you bring the two firms together, they can reduce expenses. They don't talk about how there are new opportunities to generate new sales of products by working together. Why do they spend more time talking about cost savings than revenue synergies? The argument is it's much easier to be very explicit about cost synergies. You can point to specific layoffs, plant closings, consolidations that you are going to execute when you come together. Revenue synergies? It's more pie in the sky. Will it really happen? We're going to work together to open new product sales opportunities in Latin America. How do you prove that you can do that? It's much easier to prove that we're going to consolidate two sales forces in Chicago and save money. So you see this emphasis on cost synergies and this tendency to not be able to be as explicit with revenue synergies. So if it's a revenue synergy deal, investors often are very skeptical. They want to see the proof. It's harder to prove revenue synergies. Now let's look at some theoretical explanations for why some bad deals get done. We understand the winner's curse. And we understand that we may overpay. That's a practical reason why we may see some bad deals. But what's a conceptual explanation for some of the bad deals? Here we have to introduce something called agency theory and the principal-agent problem, an important branch of economics. So one thing that the scholars in agency theory have noted is that we see the separation of ownership and control in the typical large publicly traded corporation. Ownership, the shareholders, millions of them, many shareholders, and all of them tend to own a very tiny, tiny stake in this publicly traded corporation. So we have dispersed ownership. But control, that sits in the hands of a chief executive and his or her team. Control, the executives, well, they don't actually own the company. They run it day to day. There's a difference between the owners and the people running it. In this theory, we talk about the principal. The principal is the shareholder who owns the firm. The agent is the executive, the CEO and his or her team that runs the firm. Now the question is, do the principals and the agents have the same interests? Well, think about if you're an entrepreneur and you run your own firm. You're a sole proprietor. You are both the principal and the agent. So your interests are perfectly aligned. But in a large publicly traded corporation, there's a separation between ownership and control. What are the shareholders interested in? They want to maximize the value of their shares. In other words, they want optimal profits. What are the agents interested in? What are the CEO and the other executives interested in doing? Well, they want profits. But remember, ultimately, they're utility maximizers, as all individuals are. They want to maximize their own personal utility or satisfaction. What gives them satisfaction? Well, clearly, the firm's profitability makes them happier. But they care about other things. There are other issues that make them happy. How much they're compensated. What kinds of perks they have. How much power they have. The size of the firm. Many people are happier running larger firms. The publicity that they receive. Do they make the cover of Fortune magazine? Are they featured in Fast Company? So the executives are interested in a number of things that are actually not the same as the shareholders. There's a gap here. There's a difference between the interests of executives, the agents, and the principals, the shareholders. Now, how do you align the interests of the principals and the agents? You do it through incentives monitoring. Incentives. What do companies do? They make the managers part owners of the company. They give them stock options. They give them stock itself. They do other things to make them feel like owners, maybe a bonus plan, so that they're rewarded for doing better by the shareholders. But also, the shareholders institute a monitoring mechanism. We call it the board of directors. So we appoint a group of people who are there to oversee management. But neither incentives nor the board as a control mechanism are perfect. Agency costs are the resulting misalignment that remains even after good incentive systems and monitoring devices are put in place. Why is the board not perfect? Because it's difficult to come together on a quarterly basis when you're not an expert in the business and oversee management. And so it's not a perfect way to control management's activity. And incentive schemes, they're not perfect either. So how do agency costs and the principal-agent problem explain inefficient merger and acquisition activity? Well, many executives, frankly, may be interested in empire building, not just maximizing shareholder value. They want to build a large organization. They want to make a big splash, be on the cover of Fortune for the great deal they've done. The board may not be in a position to effectively question the CEO's judgment. Moreover, the CEO may control the board in many ways. The CEO may be the chairman of the board, or the CEO may have had a big hand in selecting the board members. And so the board cannot make an independent judgment on whether this deal actually makes sense. So if the principal agent problem is one explanation for bad mergers and acquisitions that occur, another is herd behavior. What do we see in many corporations? We see the incentives for CEOs, well, they're heavily tilted toward not wanting to be fired. The CEO knows that, frankly, more and more executives are fired these days. The tenure of the average CEO has fallen. So how do you avoid being fired? Well, you might take a risk-averse approach to managing the company. And risk aversion, in part, might entail copying what other leading competitors do. If others are vertically integrated and you don't, you run the risk of looking really stupid if the vertical integration strategy proves correct and really beneficial to shareholders at rival firms. If you follow the herd and do what others are doing that are leaders in the industry and it doesn't work out, you can point to the fact that all of your rivals, including the leaders in the industry, did the same. So herd behavior is one behavior that explains why sometimes a lot of deals get done. Let's take a look at the entertainment industry, for example. In the late 1990s, we saw a wave of big deals. AOL Time Warner, NBC Universal, Viacom CBS, Disney acquiring ABC. Some of those deals worked out, others were disastrous, and some of them, well, those deals ended up getting undone. The companies later broke up. Why did those deals happen in the first place? Was it because each firm independently was coming to the conclusion that vertical integration made sense in the entertainment and media business? Or did each executive team look to others in the industry and see, well, Disney just bought ABC, vertical integration must be the wave of the future, and are they simply copying or following the herd? Too often, that's actually the underlying reason why deals get done, rather than truly independent examinations and analyses that look at the true value of bringing two firms together. Let's take a look at another industry where we've seen huge herd behavior in the past, the alcoholic beverage industry. Now, I conducted a case study on the global wine business and on overall the global alcoholic beverage industry some years ago, focusing first on Robert Mondavi, a firm that I'd gotten to know and study with the cooperation of their management team, and then looking at many of their rivals. And I noticed something interesting happening about a decade ago, in the early 2000s, in the alcoholic beverage industry. Allied to Mac, they had acquired Dunkin' Brands. They owned Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin Robbins. They were doing that to draw cash from those businesses to fund new growth in their wine business. Foster's, an Australian beer company, buying wine companies. Diageo, a company that made distilled spirits and Guinness beer, entering the wine business through mergers and acquisitions. Southcore, an Australian company merging with another Australian wine company to provide and to create a huge behemoth in the Australian wine business. What's interesting about this is many of these deals did not work out. So everybody's off doing acquisitions in the alcoholic beverage business, and then many of the deals don't work out. Southcore didn't work out at all. Foster's, it ended up splitting its beer and wine business. Some deals did work out. Beer companies that came together, just two beer companies, no other alcoholic beverages, or two spirits companies coming together. Many of those benefited from very clear economies of scale and scope, and they were good deals. But many deals that brought together beer, wine, and spirits, well, it turned out the economies of scope were not as clear. While those looked like related product markets, the synergies were not bountiful, and the deals came undone. Why'd the deals happen in the first place? Herd behavior was a big part of the story. Now you might ask, what about hostile takeovers? Why do they happen? And are they all bad? Well, I would argue they're not all a bad thing. And here we have to talk about the market for corporate control. And what does that mean? Well, there are companies out there, whether we like to admit it or not, that are poorly managed. In some cases, the managers are not doing right by the shareholders. Maybe there's an agency problem. Maybe managers are pursuing their own interests at the expense of shareholders. So why then might a hostile takeover be an important step toward improving performance? Well, hostile takeovers,